emergency, the geographic income levels, housing prices, complete with over 3 gigabytes of detailed information on the 3,000-plus counties in the U.S., full-color photographs, 550 high-resolution full-color maps, and detailed information and analysis that you need. Order Prudent Places USA now for only $29, plus shipping, by calling New Millennium at 888-803-4438. And tell them Alex Jones sent you. That's 888-803-4438, or order online at Berkey.
Well, Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king, but in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you of the views that are expressed here, and not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Mike Shedlock, and we're going to be talking about what's happening financially. Mike, are you there?
I am here, Dr. Stan, and it's a pleasure to be on the show.
Well, it's good to have you with us, and Mike, of course, is involved with financial matters. He represents a capital management firm, and he's going to be talking really about what's really going on financially. And so let's start out with a few questions. Are we facing inflation? Are we facing deflation? Are we facing both of them together? What's really going on financially? Because the value of the dollar is falling, the price of goods are raising. What's really going on?
What's really going on is we're seeing a contraction in money supply and credit that's happening right now. And it would be even more so if credit on the books was marked to market. Certainly, the value of homes are falling, and the value of mortgages sitting on the books at banks would be falling if they were marking these things to market. Also, we're seeing homeowners walk away from their homes. That's a new trend. It's called walking away, also known as jingle mail sometimes, where homeowners are just handing the keys, putting them in the mail, sending them back to the lender, and walking away. But before we can say whether it's inflation or deflation that we're facing, we have to have an agreement as to what those definitions mean. Certainly, if one says, if one thinks inflation is about rising prices, then it's kind of hard to deny that prices aren't going up. But if one views inflation and deflation properly, and I think inflation is an increase in money supply and credit, and deflation is a contraction in money supply and credit, and on that basis, I think we're seeing deflation. The Fed has been draining funds a little bit over the last month. Money supply has barely been rising, but credit, and this is where we get to, if credit was marked to market, actual value of credit on the books of corporations is plunging. We're seeing it in write-offs at Citigroup, at Merrill Lynch, at J.P. Morgan, at Lehman Brothers. Bear Stearns was $160 a share about a year ago. Bear Stearns is worth about $10 a share today, and the buyout offer to rescue Bear Stearns came in at $2. So within that context, within the frame of what inflation and deflation are, we're actually experiencing a deflation.
Well, now, what the indicators really are, the M2 and the M3. What's happening to M3?
M3 is actually soaring, but M3 represents credit transactions. Savings accounts are actually a credit transaction. People don't realize that. When they look at the value of the savings account and they say, oh, I've got $5,000 in the bank. Well, they've got a $5,000 marker at that bank, but that $5,000 has really been lent out, and the sum of all everyone's $5,000 in all these small savings accounts has been lent out. It's been lent out for all kinds of things that are going to go bust. For instance, condominium towers in Florida, in San Diego, in Phoenix, in Las Vegas. All of that money has been lent out, not really there. People think it's there, but it's been lent out. So when one looks at M3 and says, oh my gosh, M3 is soaring, well, it's soaring as a result of fractional reserve lending, banks lending out the same money over and over and over again, but the money's really not there. If one looks at base money supply, or if one looks at M1, which is essentially base money supply and checking accounts, one can see how little money is actually there versus how much money has been lent out.
Hold that thought. Hold that thought.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and with us this afternoon is Mike Shedlock. And Mike, we actually brought some other stations on board, the ones you were talking to earlier, Sydney, Arva. But they'll be joining us again in about 3 minutes. But I had asked the question, do we have inflation or do we have deflation? Well, of course, the question is, how do you define inflation? Is inflation rising prices? Yes, we've got rising prices, but Mike makes the point, and a very valid point, that inflation is really an increase in the money supply, and as a result of the fact that we have more money chasing a limited number of goods, why, of course, the price of the goods goes up. They're simply being bid up by the people. But if the inflation is the money supply, and of course there are three increments to that, M1, M2, and M3, and what is M1 doing at the present time? How much is that increasing?
M1 is actually declining. M1 is declining year over year. It's about 1% negative. M2 is actually rising about 0.6 or about 6%, and M3 is soaring at something like 18%. But M3, one of the reasons why M3 is soaring is we're seeing corporations tap existing credit lines with banks just to make sure that those credit lines don't get pulled. They're tapping these credit lines. They're depositing that money just where they can park it safely in cash, in treasuries at banks, and that's one of the factors that's causing M3 to go up. Another factor that's causing M3 to go up is we're seeing people sell out their commercial real estate properties. They have no place else that at the moment that they want to invest that money. So that money is sitting out there in savings accounts. So if one looks at the components of M3 that are rising and why those components are rising, you get a completely different picture than if one just says, oh my gosh, M3 is soaring, that's inflation. No, the real picture is M1 is contracting and there's a flight to the safety of cash that's causing M3 to keep going up.
Well, of course, the trouble is that the dollar is falling, though, in relationship to other currencies, and so as a result, things that we're importing into this country are going up, like oil. One of the big reasons for the price of oil going up certainly is the falling dollar. Isn't that true?
That is true, but there are other reasons why oil is going up besides the falling dollar. Oil is actually going up in every major currency. We're facing a situation known as peak oil, where there's diminishing amounts of oil that can be pumped
Hold that thought for just a moment here. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and just we were discussing with Mike Shedlock why the price of oil is going up. And, of course, he feels that there is peak oil and there's less oil to be produced. And yet, of course, we know that the Arab countries are actually, and OPEC, are limiting their production of oil to drive the price up. If they were operating at full power, at full speed, why, the price, there'd be an abundance of oil in the world. And certainly everything has been done to block further drilling in the United States, offshore drilling, drilling in Anwar, drilling off the North Slope, drilling on the Aleutians. I mean, they keep talking about all this oil shortage, and yet it appears that everything's been done to block oil development here in the United States.
Not only to block oil development here in the United States, Doctor, but look at our invasion of Iraq itself. And you remember the original premise when we went in there, that oil would be flowing freely? There's less oil flowing out of Iraq today than before we marched into Iraq.
How could we be so foolish unintentionally?
That's a good question. And I have a lot of people telling me, So my gosh, you know, this was a conspiracy right from the front to drive up oil prices. A part of me wants to believe that, but another part of me says, since when, does the U.S. government ever have a plan, execute it perfectly, and have that plan work? So that's what one has to believe, if they think that this was a planned event. Certainly, if it was, they carried it out to an extreme here with no one finding it out. That's the reason why I dismiss it more likely as just, you know, sheer stupidity on the part of the people that organized this war. Remember that they thought, and someone, I don't remember the name, but a top general was fired when he said that the war was going to cost $200 billion. And Rumsfeld and Cheney said, no, this war was only going to cost $60 billion. A general was fired when he said $200 billion. We're now talking trillions of dollars that we've spent over there. That's why the value of the dollar is sinking, is the amount of money we keep blowing that we don't have over in Iraq.
And in fact, there's a new book out written by, in part by Professor Joseph Stiglitz, who we've analyzed and talked to in the past. And he, of course, talks about the $3 trillion war. That's what it's going to cost us by the time we get through taking care of all these tragic casualties, victims of the Iraqi war for the rest of their lives. $3 trillion that we don't have.
An excellent book, Dr. Stan. He writes about that. He's looking at, there's something called the seen and the unseen. The seen is what the government's willing to admit. The government comes on and they say, well, these are the costs. This is how much we've spent. But the unseen is how much off the books that they're not talking about. And how much, you know, off the books that they're talking about the cost to the medical cost for these injured soldiers coming back from Iraq. That's going to go on for the rest of their lives is just insurmountable.
The destroyed lives of our young men and women who will never be the same after returning. Well, anyway, is there a liquidity crisis today? In other words, certainly we see the dollar falling. We see, of course, the M3 soaring. But then, of course, we're being told, well, all the federal government has to do is simply pour more money into the economy. And so the Fed has put, I think, about $1 trillion in the economy, and the European Central Bank put in $1 trillion. Maybe we've only put in $0.5 trillion, I'm not certain, but trillion here, trillion there, who really cares? It's all only paper money, has no value at all. There's nothing behind our currency other than the integrity of our president, of course. Certainly, do we have a liquidity crisis today? Can we actually solve the problems facing America by massively expanding the amount of money and, of course, driving the price of the dollar down even further?
Actually, we've not expanded money. It's kind of an illusion. What we've arranged is a swap. The Fed has come out. They've got the TAF and the primary dealer credit facility now, and they've got a term limit credit facility. They've got so many facilities now, it's hard to keep track of all of them. There's four of them now, I believe. But what they're actually doing is exchanging garbage mortgage-backed securities in return for treasuries. But there's actually no amount of printing that's happened yet. I guess the key word here, Dr. Stan, is yet. There's no amount of printing that's happened yet. So it's kind of misleading to say that $1 or $2 trillion has been poured in. What we have seen, though, is the Fed attempt to fight this problem by drastically lowering interest rates. So far, the ECB in Europe has held out and has not reduced. But the Bank of England came out yesterday and is talking now about doing the same things we're doing here, exchanging dodgy, worthless mortgage-backed securities for, you know, their equivalent of treasuries, and also reducing interest rates. But this is what they're trying to do is fight this with liquidity. The problem is we've got a solvency issue. Banks in the United States are essentially insolvent. If they wrote off the value of the credit that's on the books, if they actually marked this credit to market, banks in the United States would be insolvent. Bear Stearns got hit by solvency issues. Lehman Brothers is leveraged 30.1 to 1. And Citigroup is leveraged. Morgan Stanley is leveraged. All of these corporations are leveraged. If they actually mark the value of those credit default swaps and all those derivatives that they're holding on the books, if they mark those things to market, many of these corporations would be bankrupt.
Well, of course, the you say they're not expanding the money supply, but they're going to give everybody $600 to $800, $1,000, $1,200. Where's all that money coming from? They're talking about giving out $200.
That's coming from the taxpayer.
Coming
of course that's coming from the taxpayer. But one has to look at this in context, Dr. Stan. Yeah, they passed this economic stimulus package, and they're going to give up to $1,200 to everyone in the United States. And the total amount of that money was $150 billion, but $100 billion is actually going to the consumers, and $50 billion is some sort of tax credits that are going to businesses. So let's look at that $100 billion that's going out there to consumers. Some of these consumers are going to get checks of $300. The minimum is like, $300, providing they've got enough earned income, up to, $1,200. For someone that's about to lose their home, another $300, one-time shot of $300, is absolutely meaningless. And in the grand scheme of things, $150 billion sounds like a lot of money, and I don't mean to slight this. It actually is a lot of money. But in the grand scheme of things, when there's $2 trillion worth of mortgages out there and people are turning over the keys, like I was talking about before, It's like trying to put out a fire with a squirt gun. It's not going to work. All it's going to do is decrease the value of the dollar and make the problems worse.
All right, fine. Well, Chris, right now, my understanding is we're having to borrow a couple of billion dollars, $2.5 billion every day just to meet our debts. So the government really doesn't have any money. It's just everybody can get out of us through taxation. Oh, but of course, we're having to borrow money from other countries to just to keep the system going. How long can we keep living on borrowed money?
Oh, we can't. And that is another part of the deflationary argument. In the U.S., people are going to have to start learning to live within their means. It seems like we're in the credit generation. I used that term on my blog just the other day. The people don't even understand. I was responding to one woman on my blog who was upset because her home equity line of credit was reduced on her house. She goes, "I treated that as my money." Well, that's the attitude out there, Dr. Stan. Amazing as it sounds, one thinks that a home equity line of credit is actually their money. And that's the problem. We need to get back to reality here. And the Fed certainly isn't helping. They're trying to encourage people to keep spending when we're overloaded in junk coming from China that no one needs, but they keep buying it anyway. But that has to reverse. And it will reverse. The economy will eventually force it when unemployment starts to rise and the value of commercial real estate starts to plunge and banks get loaded up not just with the homes they're holding here now, but watch what happens. The economy is going to implode when commercial real estate heads south, and I think it's about to in a big way.
I certainly agree with you, but of course one of the big problems is not so much the people, although I agree with you, the people are spending more than they should, but the government's spending more than they should. If the government has to borrow a couple of billion dollars a day, $2.5 billion a day, and they've been doing it for some time, can the government continue doing that indefinitely?
No, they can't, and that's going to be wave two. Right now, the big problem in the economy, 70% of the economy is consumer. Consumer debt is standard deviations above the norm of what it should be. We saw the same thing with housing. Our home prices were three standard deviations above rental prices, and above historic trends. Well, we all know that when trends reverse, they don't just go back to the trend. They go below the trend. They dip in the other direction. So we are just now in a couple of years into a housing downturn that's probably going to last at least another 4 years. So that's going to force people to home equity lines are just going to vanish because people are going to be so underwater on their houses that there's no equity now to withdraw. And it was that home equity spending that was one of the things that was keeping this country going.
Hold that thought, Mike. We'll be right back. Okay, Mike, you were just saying that was the home equity spending using the houses as a piggy bank that was giving people the money to spend and spend and spend. But as the value of their homes drops, pretty soon they're going to have a larger loan on their house, the primary, and then the home equity loan, than the value of the property. And then they're going to be in real trouble because they're going to be paying both the bank and the mortgage company for a home that that isn't worth what they're paying for.
Exactly, Dr. Sam, exactly. What's going to happen then is they're going to have to, consumers, one of two things. They're either going to have to cut back on other spending they're doing, or they're going to hand over the keys and walk away. Neither one of them is what the Fed wants. The Fed can only influence the major trend. Once consumers get into a different mindset, and I've had people tell me, Mish is my nickname, by the way, so you can refer to me as Mish or Mike, either one, but people would say to me, Mish, you know, you're wrong. You know, you can't compare the U.S. to what was happening over there in Japan. You know, Japan was a nation of savers. The U.S. is a nation of spenders. Well, we go through cycles, and Japan, yes, was a nation of savers, and the U.S. is a nation of spenders, but the U.S. was not always a nation of spenders. The U.S., as little as 10, 12 years ago, we had a decent positive savings rate. It's all vanished, and part of the reason why it's vanished is because the value of the dollar has been going down, and so consumers have been, they know that prices of goods have been rising. They're trying to spend the money as fast as they can, but they've spent it on assets like homes that are now plunging in value, and now they're stuck. Now, as long as those asset prices were going up, they could keep spending. But asset prices are going down now. They can't keep spending. And after all of this, this consumer debt is deflated away, and it's going to be deflated away by bankruptcies, and we're seeing rising bankruptcies now. Again, that's part of the deflationary thesis that I'm on. But once that debt is deflated away, then we have the massive amount of unfunded liabilities, of Social Security, of Medicaid, of Medicare, and the U.S. needs to do something. We can no longer afford to be the world's policeman. We are spending trillions of dollars stationing troops in Japan, in Germany, in Europe, in the Mideast, fighting wars that don't need to be fought. And we're going to have a referendum on this election about whether or not we need to bring those troops home from Iraq, and in what time frame. And if it was up to me, I would bring the troops home from Iraq, from Germany, from Japan. Europe doesn't need the U.S. to defend itself. Who are we defending Europe against? If Europe wants to be defended against someone, then maybe Europe should pay money to defend themselves. Instead, what we've got is a corporate handout to can't be polite, the warmongers here in the United States that are running the gun companies, the gun manufacturers,
Hold that thought, we'll be right back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Mike Shedlock, who's a financial advisor. We were just talking about really what's going on today. Mike was saying that if it were up to him, he would bring the troops home. Not only the troops home from Iraq and Afghanistan, but from Japan, where they've been stationed for 60 years, from South Korea, from Europe. We've had our troops stationed over there. We've got troops stationed in 130 nations, and you know what, over 700 bases throughout the world. Most people don't understand that America has an empire, and you can't afford an empire because empires end up bankrupting your country, and America is bankrupt. We're having to borrow money every single day to the tune of about certainly a couple of billion dollars a day simply to pay our debts. And you can't keep doing it indefinitely. So basically the next question is having to do with China and India. Now, certainly China is growing and growing very rapidly thanks to the transfer of literally hundreds of billions of dollars from American taxpayers into China under one guise or another. And certainly then, of course, we have India doing quite well financially. These are really growing societies, and of course there's increased consumption in those countries, and the people are really moving out of poverty, but they've got well over a third of the population of the world in those two countries, and may soon have half the population of the world. Can they decouple from the rest of the world and survive this coming financial collapse?
That's an interesting question. No. Right now, they cannot decouple. We might need to revisit this question, say, 20 years from now, but right now it's kind of the tail wagging the dog. Yes, those economies are expanding rapidly, but if one looks at the total gross domestic product, say, of China and India, and compares that to the United States, Europe, and the UK, then there's simply no comparison there. I believe that the U.S. is in recession, and I don't think there's any question about that anymore. But the UK is heading into recession. The Eurozone is heading into recession. So eventually, much of the demand produced from China and India and the Third World is to support U.S. consumption. Well, when the U.S. heads into consumption and cuts back here on what we buy, this means there's going to be rampant overcapacity then coming out of China. And China is overheating. And if one wants to discuss inflation, actually, China's kind of interesting because there is rampant printing of money going on in China and Asia. They're attempting to hold down the value of their currencies. They've pegged to the U.S. dollar. Yet, because the balance of trade that you've talked about here, when you said we were being financed by foreign governments, yes, we're being financed by China. So we've got a balance of trade of U.S. dollars going to China, but in a normal situation, those dollars would be sterilized. The foreign governments would step on the brakes over there. The values of their currencies would rise, but to prevent the values of the currencies of rising, to prevent the official name is renminbi, but to prevent, people call it informally the yuan, to prevent the yuan from rising, the government of China has been massively printing yuan and therefore accumulating massive reserves of U.S. dollars. So inflation in China is running absolutely rampant. What we've got is just an entire disconnect throughout this world economy of everyone trying to keep the U.S. consumer spending when it's no longer possible.
And I agree with you totally. Now, what's going to happen to the oil prices? And certainly this is something of concern, I think, to everybody. As we're looking at Sydney, very near, very soon, will be over $4 right here in where I live. Certainly your premium gasoline is over $4. We've seen it skyrocketing. But, you know, we'd like to know what you think is going to happen to those oil prices. Are they going to go down? Are they going to continue rising up to $5, $6, you know, $7 for a gallon of gasoline?
It could even get higher than that. The problem is here, now we're guessing. We're guessing about what policies that are going to come out of the next administration, when right now we don't even know who the next administration is. But let's just take it, let's say McCain wins, and he keeps supporting the war in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and heaven forbid someone gets the idea that they want to attack Iran. Now, I mean, $10 oil, $10 gallon gas is not out of the question. And on the other hand, if we pull our troops out of Iraq and we start dialogue...
Hold that thought. I'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Mike Sedlock. We're talking about, of course, the price of oil. And of course, Mike says that it's really dependent upon what happens in the Near East, in the Middle East, who gets elected president. But you really think that if, for instance, Obama was the president, he would bring our troops home immediately? I mean, he said he's not going to, you know, my understanding is they're not going to come home immediately. They'll come home when, of course, we're not going to harm our position over there. What do you think would happen if Obama or Hillary became president? Do you really think that they would simply turn things around? Certainly, Richard Nixon promised if we elected him in 1968, he'd bring our boys home from Vietnam, and he didn't do it. And in 1972, he promised that if we just re-elect him, he'd bring our boys home from Vietnam, and he eventually did bring them home. Of course, he left thousands behind and of course, turned the country over to the communists. But do you really think that either the Democrats are going to do any better than the Republicans? Certainly, the Democrats have voted to continue financing the war when they promised they wouldn't. Do you think that they really would have a different agenda?
Well, let me just get in the plug here for Ron Paul, if I can.
All right, go ahead.
I am a big Ron Paul supporter. I love Ron Paul. I voted for Ron Paul here in the Illinois primary. We need to... he has the right attitude. He would do it. He would do it immediately. And he would cut off all of this other funding. He would cut off tariffs. He would bring the troops home. He would have our troops defend our borders. Not the borders in Japan, not the borders in Asia, not the borders in Europe. But the sad reality is Ron Paul is not going to be elected. So now we have to look at the choices at which we're facing. Well, it's clear that McCain has said that he will stay in the region for 100, he actually said 100 years. So we know what McCain would do. Now, we can only guess what the other two would do. I believe that Hillary would stay in Iraq. I don't believe she would pull the troops home. She has defended her decision to support the war. Obama is an unknown. What we know is that he said that he would try and bring the troops home. Hillary has said the same thing, but in a wishy-washy manner that no one can possibly believe. So in that regard, you know, Obama's our best shot. Now, will he do it? I don't know. And how long would it take for oil to start flowing freely out of Iraq if we did?
Hold that thought for just a moment, Mike. Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course our guest is Mike Sedlock, who's a financial consultant. And before we go on, Mike, would you like to get any information out about yourself? Do you have a website, anything of that sort?
Oh, sure. Actually, the best way to find me is to do a Google search for Mish. I just run by the nickname of Mish, M-I-S-H. If you do a Google search for that, you can find me. My blog is actually globaleconomicanalysis.blogspot.com. That's much tougher to remember than Mish. So just do a Google search for Mish. You can find my blog. I write several times a day, usually on my blog. I am a representative of Sitka Pacific Capital Management. I'm an investment advisor rep for Sitka Pacific. And you can get a hold of me on my blog, find the link to Sitka, or you can email me at mikeshedlock@gmail.com. And any of those, you should be able to find me. And I certainly appreciate the opportunity to pass that information along, Dr. Stan.
Well, let's just ask, Sydney, what should people be doing investment-wise at the present time? Should they be in stocks? Should they be in T-bills? Should they be in gold and silver? What should people be doing with their money as the dollar is falling and falling rapidly?
The best advice for people is to be prepared to lose their job. Regardless of what one thinks the dollar is going to do, I think it's likely to put in a correction here. Things, no matter how bad the dollar is or looks, things don't go where they're going to get in a straight line. But the problem here is people are too ill-prepared for what might happen. I think unemployment is going to rise massively in the United States. If people want to protect their houses, I mean, if they're so far underwater that they don't care anymore, then that's one thing. But those that do want to protect their houses, that have some equity in those houses, need to be prepared for the loss of a job. And that means that they need to cut back on spending, live within their means, save up some money, have a full year's worth of supply of money in the bank. Not credit, not a line of credit against their house that can be taken away at any time, primarily through falling home prices. Or just restrictions in lending period, as we've seen with Citigroup and Countrywide Financial. But actual cash on hand that they can weather a storm should they lose their job. That is the number one thing that people ought to be doing now, is cutting back on spending on things they don't need and can't afford. And that's where it has to start. Now, once we get beyond that as to where one should be invested, it's equity markets and the gold market and the commodity markets, foreign equity markets, everything since 2002, 2003 have been rising together in unison. You could have taken a shotgun and pretty much, fired a shotgun and hit something that was moving up. Well, what was correlated on the way up is likely to be correlated on the way down for a number of years. And I'm looking for the S&P to possibly fall back down to 1,100. And if that target doesn't hold, then I don't want to say target. If we got there and that didn't hold, then we could see a complete unwind all the way back to 2002, 2003 bottom. But some things are going to stand out. Certainly, energy is going to be one of the things that's constantly in demand. So if one was looking for a sector to overweight, one would pick energy. And gold is kind of interesting because we've had a big mammoth run-up in gold from $250 to over $1,000. Well, is now the time to invest in gold? It could be. I'm not a big gold bug, but I'm in favor of having some percentage of assets in gold and hard commodities just in case. And that's one theme: gold, energy. Those are the themes. I think credit and financing have not bottomed yet. So those would be sectors to avoid. But for someone that just has a small amount of money, $10,000, $20,000, and they don't know what to do with it, I would tell those persons to put the money into CDs. And you're only going to get 2 or 3% or what on that, but at least your capital preservation at this moment is of paramount importance. It's gains are opportunities are far easier to make up, Dr. Stan. Opportunities are easier to make up than losses. And capital preservation right now is paramount.
I certainly agree with that capital preservation is paramount. What percentage should people, if they have a moderate amount of money, maybe $50,000, $100,000, what percentage of that should be in gold and silver?
That's really hard to say. It depends on one's risk tolerance.
All right.
You can find people that would have 100% in there, but a lot of those people were also in, all the way from 250 up, and you can find them that were in from 500 down to 250 and are still holding on and have now doubled their money. So, it's hard to say. 10 or 15%, I think, would be a reasonable amount. depending on one's risk tolerances, I suppose one could go a lot higher, you know, maybe 20-25%. But that's a pretty steep position. I would say 10 or 15% is reasonable. And right now, if you know, one of the things that we're doing at Sitka Pacific is, you know, we look at sectors that are in favor, that are out of favor. And although we like gold over the long haul, we recently got out of gold at 980. Seasonally, gold is going to be out of favor from now and through until about July. And the sentiment on gold was so overwhelmingly positive that we just said, okay, we're going to take our profits in this and exit. So, you know, that's what we did. That's not a recommendation. I need to make that clear. We don't give recommendations like this. But, you know, that is what we did, and it may be right or may not be right, but it all depends on one's time frame. If one is looking, you know, that wants to put their money safe that they might need next year, that's a completely different scenario than if one is 35 and is investing for their retirement. So there really is no answer here until you look on an individual basis and say, you know, what's prudent for someone at age 35 is no longer prudent for someone whose age is 60.
All right, now what's going to happen to the dollar? Is it going to continue losing its value? Do you think it's going to come back again and soar once again?
Oh, I don't think it's going to soar, but I don't think the euro is the answer either. The euro had an extremely big run-up, and a lot of that was based on petrodollars. A lot of that was based on the Arab oil states diversifying out of the U.S. dollar into euros. That really hammered the U.S. dollar a lot. But if fundamentally you look at what's really going on behind the euro, you'll see that M3 is rising as fast in Europe as it is in the United States, for those that watch M3. You will see that the expansion of credit is happening in the Eurozone as fast as it is here in the United States. And you also see that German banks are in at least as bad a shape as what's happening in the United States. And the thing is, in the United States, we don't hear about this. The U.S. is so U.S.-centric that we don't hear about what's going on in Europe, in the U.K., and elsewhere. However, In the Eurozone, and on my blog, I have people communicating me from Dubai, from India, from Germany, from Switzerland, from Australia. Those people understand and know what's happening in the United States, and it's really sad that most people in the United States don't understand what's happening in the rest of the world. But if one looks, if we get outside the shell of all the things that are going wrong here in the United States, we can find some of the same things going wrong in Europe. The property bubble in the UK and in Spain and in Ireland is as bad as what's going on here in the United States. But people in the United States are not aware of that. People in Europe are aware of all of those problems, plus they're aware of what's going on here in the United States. So what happens then in the United States? Oh, my gosh, look at all these problems. The U.S. dollar is going to keep going to hell. Maybe not, because maybe the problems in Europe are as bad, and no one realizes it yet.
All right, fine. Well, now what about the carry trade? And could you explain to our listeners what the carry trade is and why that is so vitally important to the American economy today?
Oh, well, sure. The carry trade is borrowing in a low interest rate country, and using that borrowed money to buy assets in a higher interest rate country. For example, interest rates in Japan are right now at 0.5%, 0.5%, and just a year ago they were at 0.25%, 0.25. So what was happening is people were borrowing money at 0.25%, saying, "My gosh, you know, we can get 5% return on T-bills in the United States. So we can borrow money at 0.5% and get 5% in the U.S. And literally trillions of dollars have been borrowed in yen to buy, you know, in the U.S. Well, eventually, all of these carry trades blow up because, you know, what's happening now is interest rates in Japan are starting to rise. They rose just modestly from a quarter to a half, but interest rates in the United States are falling, and the U.S. dollar is falling on top of it. So the value of the yen versus the U.S. dollar is rising. So all of these people that hoarded into the carry trade now actually have a currency loss, even that exceeds what they were making on the interest rate differential. All of these carry trades blow up, and the unwind of that carry trade means that anyone that invested in U.S. assets is going to sell them. That puts pressure on, and especially if they were in equities or gold or other markets, they've got to sell those assets now to pay back the loans in the end. That's what's going on with the carry trade. The unwind of that has just started, and it has a big negative factor looming over not only just the stock market here in the United States, but there was a carry trade going on with Europe and the UK as well, essentially started from Japan with their interest rates at 0.25%.
And then first, this is what the hedge funds were doing, and they were leveraging a lot of this too, and it's great, you know, when things are going in your favor, but if they turn against you, you might be, you know, facing the loss of literally hundreds of millions of dollars based upon what you've done. And so when these things begin to turn around, why, there's real problems. Now, what about our derivatives? Could you explain what derivatives are and why so many people are so concerned about the derivative market?
A derivative is just really something that's derived from something else. It's a bet on... a derivative can be, you know, really a bet on anything. And a credit default swap is where I think the real problem is. And what a credit default swap is a bet on whether or not the credit of a particular company is going to be any good or not. For example, someone might have buy GM bonds and say, well, you know, what happens if General Motors goes bankrupt, for example? So they buy a protection on that, and that protection is called a credit default swap, where someone agrees to guarantee that GM will pay off on those bonds that were bought. But what's happened is the bets made on credit default swaps have dwarfed the underlying bonds. So we've gone from a product that had a real use as a hedge against something, you know, that a bond investor was worried about, holding those GM bonds, to something that hedge funds are just betting outright, speculating on whether or not a company is going to go bankrupt. And there's $50 trillion worth of credit default swaps on there that dwarfs the entire U.S. economy, and all of these bets are sitting out there, you know, betting on the health of a company, whether or not it's going to go bankrupt and in what time. And actually, this is part of the Bear Stearns bailout. If Bear Stearns is a huge market in credit default swaps, where it's a counterparty, it's guaranteed. A lot of these credit default swaps, the Fed was paranoid. They were frightened by the fact that Bear Stearns might go bankrupt. So what do? They orchestrated this a bailout of where J.P. Morgan bought the assets of Bear Stearns. The Fed was so frightened by this that the Fed agreed to back $30 billion worth of essentially these credit default swaps that are sitting on Bear Stearns' books that J.P. Morgan was afraid of. Well, I'm sorry, that bailout should not have happened if J.P. Morgan wanted to buy Bear Stearns. That's fine. And in fact, they probably would have without the guarantee from the Fed, because J.P. Morgan is one of the counterparties, to some of those swaps that were being held by Bear Stearns. You can see how this whole mess all ties together in one big line of dominoes, and this was going to be one enormous domino that was going to fall if Bear Stearns actually went bankrupt. The Fed stepped in to prevent it, but technically it shouldn't have happened, and it was technically illegal what they did.
All right, fine. And of course, that's J.P. Morgan Chase, the combination of the Rockefeller Bank with the Morgan Bank, and certainly one of the largest banks. I think Citicorp is the largest bank in the United States, and J.P. Morgan, I think Bank of America is second, and J.P. Morgan Chase would be third or fourth, somewhere in there. So I think that Bear Stearns was the fifth largest bank in the United States, an investment bank, and it almost, of course, went into bankruptcy a little over a week ago. And it may still go into bankruptcy if the people who are actually holding the stock object to this business deal, where they're going to get $10 a share for a stock that simply was selling for $170 a share a little over a year ago. So we're seeing this whole contraction of the whole monetary system. What do you think is going to happen, Mike? How soon do you think we're going to hit bottom? How soon do you think we'll start to bounce back, or will we bounce back? What's going to happen to the dollar?
In terms of, let's take housing first, because I don't think the economy can bottom until housing bottoms. Just looking at the stats that I see, subprime has already blown up. And it's really misleading when the Fed and the Secretary of the Treasury, Paulson, comes out and says, well, you know, subprime crisis is over. Well, maybe the subprime crisis isn't over, but maybe it's three-quarters over.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment. Go right ahead with your thoughts there, Mike.
Okay. The problem goes way beyond subprime. The big problem, actually, is in Alt-A and pay option ARM. And in Alt-A and pay option ARM, that's where all the liar loans were hidden. That's where all the people that came out and said that they were making $60,000, $80,000, $200,000 a year when they were really making $20,000 a year and went out and bought $500,000 homes in California. Now, you know, they're stuck in these loans. They're stuck in these houses. They can barely afford to pay them. And that's why, you know, we've seen, you know, so many walkaways and hand over the keys. But the subprime loans are resetting right now, but the bulk of the pay option ARMs and the bulk of the Alt-A ARMs, those don't reset until 2011. And that the number of those, the value on the number of those, because remember those were the higher priced houses, you know, not the typical subprime, you know, mortgage maybe on a $150 house. We're talking mortgages on million-dollar houses now, they're going to be worth $500,000. You know, that's a big hit for any bank that has to take back that loan when someone walks away. That's not going to peak until 2011. So I don't see any realistic chance of the economy bottoming until housing bottoms, and we're looking at 4 years away. Now, you know, the stock market may or, you know, it really depends. The stock market could crash. It wouldn't surprise me, but it may not. We may just slowly drift down, just like Japan did. And when looking at Japan, home prices in Japan fell for 18 consecutive years. They rose last year for the first time in 19 years. I don't think we're going to go as far as they did, but for people to come out and say this is the bottom right now, when we're only a year and a half or 2 years into this, you can look them straight in the face and say, "No, you don't have a 30-year boom be corrected in a year and a half bust, especially when this was the biggest boom in history." So, you know, that's hard to add more than that because we don't know again what the next Congress is going to attempt to do. The right thing for Congress to do.
Mike, I'm going to have to interrupt you because we're out of time, but I want to thank you so very much for being with us here. It's been a fascinating hour, and I wish you well. Thanks so very much for being a guest here on Radio Liberty.
Thank you very much, Dr. Stan.
Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I hope you learned something from our conversation. My concern, as I remember, M2 is going up about 7.2% at the present time. M3 is up about 16%, and these are, of course, the guides to inflation. Sydney, I would say, and M3 is very, very close to the inflation. In other words, where M3 is today, we will be at the probably the end of this year, the first of next year. Right now, inflation's running about 10 to 12%. Contrary to everything you're being told, why the value of your money is being destroyed, 10 to 12% a year. And I think that we're going to go into a very hyperinflation, and then I think we're going to go into a deflation, and an awful lot of people are going to be wiped out. You really need to understand what's going on. And let me suggest my talk on the financial tsunami. And the syllabus that goes with that, that has a lot of information from the Federal Reserve System. And you can utilize that, you know, go up there on your own computer and see what the M1, the M2, and the M3 are. And you'll learn what these things really are all about in my talk, Financial Tsunami, and you get the syllabus as well. Then, of course, we do hope that many of you out there will want to get the book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, which really explains that our entire financial system is based upon nothing but debt, and when the debt dissolves, the currency dissolves, and the system collapses. The book, The Federal Reserve Conspiracy, by Professor Sutton. The book, Fiat, Money, Inflation in France, by Andrew Dixonson White, who was the dean of Cornell University 100 years ago, and we carry his book, which tells you what happened in 1789. When the French revolutionaries, of course, went to a fiat money system, repudiated the system of gold that had been traditional in France, and of course what happened when they went on to that fiat money system. And the same thing happened, has always happened, with countries that have gone on fiat money. They ended up with a dictator. His name was Napoleon Bonaparte. To understand the history of money, we have a little pamphlet called The History of Money. And then we have another pamphlet. They're inexpensive. I think they're only $3.95 each plus shipping. The Financial Meltdown, which is a compilation of my five of my newsletters and going into the background of how Alan Greenspan intentionally and maliciously and purposely created what's going on today. The question is not what did he do, but why did he do it? And, well, you just have to read the pamphlets. I do not know what's in his heart, but I do know that he has destroyed the value of the savings of most of the people in the United States. And most of our people, before this is over, are going to be impoverished. You need to know what's going on. You need to make your plans accordingly. So let me suggest again my talk on the financial tsunami and the syllabus, and you get them both together, you get a reduced price. The book, Creature from Jekyll Island, and I will tell you that many times we'll sell 20 copies of that book a week. You know, it's phenomenal the way it's going, because people are concerned about what's happening. They want to protect themselves. Then we suggest a book, The Federal Reserve Conspiracy, because the Federal Reserve is a privately owned central bank that was set up to enrich the bankers and impoverish the people. And then the book, Fiat Money Inflation in France, the two pamphlets, Financial Meltdown and The History of Money. And if you read all of those, you'll know more than most college professors, and hopefully some of you will be able to preserve your what you've worked your whole life for. Let me tell you right now, the worst thing you can do is get into CDs or treasury bills. They're simply certificates of guaranteed confiscation in a time of inflation, and we are in inflation today. Now, we're not always going to be in inflation. Eventually, the whole thing will begin to contract, but while we're in the inflationary spiral, you do not want to be in anything that ties your life savings and everything you work for simply to a fiat money system that is imploding. So we hope you'll give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. You'll go ahead and you'll get information, or simply listen to our programs regularly, my conversations regularly with Bob Chapman, or certainly my conversations with Ron Brown. Or we're going to be doing a program at 9 o'clock tonight with Melody Cedarstrom, talking about these issues. Please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for my ministry, for our provision and our protection.
You're listening to the Global Star Radio Network, located at Telstar 5 KU band, frequency 11836, symbol rate 20770. Thank you for listening.